This is the Fucking Normal Podcast, the cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Fucking Normal, where today our topic is dueling neurodiversity, and we will talk about the parenting experience when both child and parent are neurodivergent. So neurodiversity describes the variation in the human experience of the world, the idea that people experience and interact with the world around them in many different ways. There's no one right way of thinking, learning, or behaving, and differences should not be viewed as deficits. As parents to neurodiverse children, we all see firsthand how often neurovariants can butt up against an ableist world full of social expectations and neurotypical norms. But with reportedly 15 to 20% of the world's population exhibiting some form of neurodivergence, isn't this just fucking life in all its richness? Is it? And isn't the world all the better for all this diversity?
So our guest today is Bryony Kimmings, famous for her brutally honest autobiographical shows. Most recently, she created I'm a Phoenix Bitch, which touches on motherhood and mental health. So Bryony was diagnosed as having ADHD at the age of 40. Her son Frank is 7 and is autistic. Bryony was diagnosed the same year that Frank got his autism diagnosis, and it's fair to say that they're doing neurodiversity in their own way. But before we chat to Bryony, I want to provide some clear context for people who don't know. ADHD, in medical terms, is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's a condition which is characterized by inattentiveness, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. Plus, it includes positive traits like hyperfocus, creativity, spontaneity, and resilience. Autism, or ASC, autism spectrum condition, refers to the broad range of conditions characterized by social and communication differences, repetitive behaviors, reliance on rules and boundaries and routines, and an increased sensitivity to different stimulus such as sounds, taste, and touch. Welcome, Bryony.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming on The Fucking Normal.
Exactly how I feel.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm really cold in my house and the heating's off, and I'm like excited but also in a little ball.
That's the way to be.
As am I. Plus I've got a hot tea so I can like warm my hands constantly.
Oh, sorry.
Good idea.
So I guess we'd like to start with talking about not the very beginning, but the you and Frank and your diagnoses, given that's what the topic is. It's about neurodiversity and the fact that you both share that kind of neurodiverse label. I mean, maybe it would be helpful to first introduce yourself and Frank and tell us a bit more about Frank and what he's like before we get into the diagnosis.
What's Frank like? He's a little joyful being. He's very into nature. He's very chatty. He's really emotional and needs quite a lot of emotional reassurance. He's quite sparkly, like stressing up, putting on shows. Doesn't sound like anyone you know.
Apple tree.
Yeah, I know. It's really difficult to know whether I've just forced it upon him or he is actually naturally a performer. He's sensitive, sparkly and sensitive, I'd say.
What kind of precipitated the diagnosis process for Frank? And then so does Frank diagnose as autistic first and then yourself? What could tell us about that year? Yeah. What happened? Why did you guys seek the diagnoses?
Yeah, interestingly, I'd been, you know, we're all friends, we all know one another's children, and I'd been really adamant with Claire, another one of our friends who's done this podcast, like, Frank isn't autistic, like, he's just doesn't display those symptoms, like, I look at Ada and he's not like her, and, you know, like, and I can, after it all happened, she sort of looked at me and was like, well, I obviously knew he was, but you can't say that to somebody else. You have to let them go on their own journey. So I think for me, it was like really shocking when the neurologist sort of said, I think we're going to test him for autism. Because I was just like, I think like most people, I was like, well, he's not Rain Man. He doesn't count cards when I drop them on the floor. He doesn't love maths, you know. So, and I think I was looking at it through that sort of really, I suppose, media kind of concocted version of it. And so I still went into the assessment when he was like five thinking, this kid's not autistic. Like, yeah, he's got disabilities. He's got, you know, he's got neurological differences, but he's not autistic. And then we got the diagnosis of atypical, you know, it's like, oh, what's that mean? So I looked that up and was like, oh, he doesn't, you know, like he's not presenting in the sort of maybe the dominant version of that. Of that, what that looks like, the spectrum looks like, but he's certainly displaying some of the elements of it. So then it's like, okay, where is he on the spectrum? I can remember saying that to him, like, well, if this is a line and this is good and high functioning and verbal and intelligent and will be Bill Gates or, you know, whoever, Steve Jobs, and then on the other end is like non-verbal, you know, bad, good or bad, you know. And they were like, oh, here's a book on autism. And it's not a spectrum like a line, it's a spectrum like a circle. And if you imagine a colour spectrum, like there's 7 or 8 different things that can be present in an autistic person, and they'll have different gradients of each of those. And that's why it's called a spectrum, like a colour spectrum. So, oh, okay. You know, so I'm like scrabbling around thinking, he's not autistic, then what even is autism? You know, I don't think I'd even like thought about it. I had a friend who was, when I was growing up in my teenage years, who had a severely autistic brother, and it's just, that's just what I think of autism as, you know. So I was so shocked at him, and so I think, you know, as with all of these things, grief comes into it. You know, grieving some kind of dream, even when your child has complex disabilities like my child, and everything's always changing and everything can slide backwards or stop, you're still, as soon as you get something, aren't you, you're sort of going, well, at least I can fixate on that, you know, in the future, that, and then something will come along and punch that off you, and you'll be like, okay, well, he might not ride a bike, but like, okay, what about that? Maybe he'll be able to write his name. You know, you're always just scrabbling around for sort of the logical next step or the way in which you can kind of deal with it. And I think I spent like 3 months just like, what the hell am I going to do? Like, I've got to change everything I've been doing. Like, I was disciplining him, you know, disciplining an autistic kid for basically being autistic is like, like, I still think about it now and hate myself for it. You know, I have to really work hard not to really go into the doom about those kinds of things. But yeah, okay, change everything. Everything needs to change. So it's like, did a course, they send you on a course, don't they? It was love to send you on a course. You have a couple of courses, read this book. You're like, okay, sure, I haven't got a full-time job and I'm not a full-time single mom. Don't worry, I'll just absorb all of the stuff. And I revolutionized kind of how everything worked in our house. And of course, when you do that for an autistic person, you're creating an environment that helps them to thrive, right? So you're creating the non-medical mm-hmm. model of disability. Yeah. You're creating the social model. What do you need? What do you feel? And trying things for like a few months, it was like someone had sprinkled magical dust on our house. It was like, you know, like I got a key yeah. to the
amazing.
Door.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But because I was doing all that stuff, you know, pecs, pointing images to point out, what do you want, this or this, and how do you feel, and what do you need? And I started to think, oh my God, like, I need this stuff, right? This stuff's really great. Like, This stuff's amazing. It's like, shit. So my therapist had said to me a few times, I think you might be ADHD, right? And I was like,
and what did you know what that meant?
You know, like, no. So like, and this is the thing again, like, even though you've got a disabled kid, you're still like, I'm not ADHD. ADHD are little boys who fucking throw themselves out of windows in naughty schools, you know, like, I'm not ADHD, like, shut up.
So it wasn't so like you'd already heard, like, it wasn't like the ADHD kind of diagnosis came out of like left field. You'd already had somebody talk about it with you.
It was around the same time, and I remember going into my therapy, probably one of the last times I actually saw her in person before the pandemic. And like, you know, another story of like how I'd overdrank at the weekend, or I'd spent money on my credit card that I didn't have, and like, or like I'd just like destroyed something just to like just destroy it and then stress out about getting it all back together again, you know, like just this constant repetitive destroying destructive behavior. And like, you know, when you're in your 30s, maybe your 20s even more so, but like not when you're in your 40s, like you're like, it's I used to think it was cool, you know, I'm edgy, like I just like I just go places, I trash them, you know, like. And then it's like you get to 14, like, what am I doing? Like, I'm a parent, you know, like you're not a kid. This isn't rock and roll. This is actually real life. And she sort of just, I don't know why she did it this way, but she just sort of went, as I was sort of walking out the door, she was like, I think you might be ADHD.
Way to deliver it.
You know, like, I don't know. She never really explained why she did it like that. And I don't know whether she just hadn't thought about it, but it was just, I just remember being out in the street all of a sudden being like, nah. And then
did it make you then, think, did you stop and be like, hold on a second, maybe?
Well, it was in there, you know, like it was in there. So when I was getting Frank's autism stuff, it was in there. And I think Tim and I, that's Frank's dad, I think both of us have always toyed with the idea that maybe both of us are neurodiverse in some way. Like, I mean, when you have a disabled kid, this, you know, they're testing you genetically, they're asking you about your own lives, and you start to think, hey man, maybe this is coming from me. You don't really think about it until then, do you? You don't, if you don't identify as disabled, if you have a disabled child, suddenly you're like, okay, what part of that child is me? Yeah. And was it me? Was it my genes? Was it my, you know? So I think we had been thinking about it, but yeah, no, it was like when I started to do all the PECS stuff and all the kind of like looking at trying to make our house into a neurodiverse kind of wonderland, that it was like, oh my God, like, I think she might be right.
I was just going to say, that changed how you then viewed your life looking back when you started to kind of learn more about ADHD. Did you see yourself very differently in terms of your childhood and the 20s?
Yeah,
and 30s?
Of course. Like, of course. Oh my God. It was like, so first of all, I was like, okay, this obviously isn't just little boys in a classroom. This is like, I need to really look at it. So I listened to an audiobook because, hey guys, funnily enough, I've never been able to sit and read a book because I'm ADHD, you know, like, so I listened to this audiobook, Sari Solden, it's by Sari Solden, it's something like Women Who Have ADHD, because people had started to get diagnosed a bit more, friends of mine were talking about it was starting to be a thing, and it's a real thing now, and so I listened to it, and everything, you know, everything she said was like, oh my God, it was like ticking off a list, and that for me was a really difficult thing, because I think I thought I knew myself, you know, like I thought I knew everything. I mean, I always say this in every stage of my life, like, I know everything. No, you don't. Like, it's maybe I should just stop thinking I know everything. But it was like, oh my goodness me. Okay. So it opened this like wound, I'd say, an old wound that perhaps I'd always had, but I hadn't, it had always been like, oh, don't touch that wound. Like, don't touch that. Like, you know, it was like, don't touch that. And then it was like, okay, I'm going to have to touch that now. to get assessed, you have to, a bit like Frank, really, you have to speak to your mum, right? You have to, your mum has to, yeah, like, which is really hard, right? Even if you have a good relationship with your mum, it's critical, isn't it? In a way, it's like, okay, you get a form and it's like, right, so, for example, do you stim? Like, do you flap your hands or jump up and down when you feel happy or anxious? Like, no, I don't in adulthood, but I feel like I want to a lot, but I don't, right? And then I'm sitting with my mum, like, did I presumably didn't do that as a, oh, do that as a kid, like, oh, no, 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 yeah, you used to, like, trot on the ground like a horsey, and we used to say, oh, stop being a horsey, you know? So it's like, cool. Like, you know, try not to react, because that's your mum and you don't want to be like, didn't you think that that was strange? But also it was the early 80s and no one knew about this stuff. So I was trying not to be critical, but, you know, thinking to myself, if I, like, thinking about that moment when I thought, oh my God, I disciplined Frank for having a meltdown. It wasn't a tantrum, it was a meltdown. And then thinking, that's happened to me. That happened to me. Stop trotting. Stop pretending to be a horse. Keep still, you know? So I was, I suppose, grieving myself while simultaneously also trying to ensure that he didn't have the same experience. So I guess in some ways it was really positive because it was like, I know this. But in other ways it was really negative and sad because it was like, I had to unpick everything. It's like putting a whole new lens on everything and looking through it and saying, oh, that's why I never had good relationships. Oh, that's why I've never been good with money. Oh, that's why I'm hypersensitive to emotions and people have always said I'm dramatic. You know, that's why I have a job as a performance artist where people clap me every day because it's dopamine I'm looking for. Like, that's why I drink so much. That's why I've had sex addiction. Like, it's like everything.
Did you feel seen? Because it must have felt like, oh, wow, like you've got a mirror that's like held up to you and you finally can understand yourself a little bit more. I can imagine it feeling quite liberating in a way.
It was after a while. First of all, it was devastating. And then it was, now I think of it as a gift, you know, it's unlocked many things, one of which is self-care and knowledge of oneself enough to change the patterns or to live more as myself. But yeah, I think once I was medicated and once I realized that, first, you know, this is me again, like, oh, I'm not, he's got that wrong, he scored up the form in front of me and said, oh yeah, you're definitely ADHD, and I was like, yeah, you don't know anything, you know. And he was like, well, the best way to know and the way in which we can definitely confirm it is if you respond to medication. I'm going to give you some seriously strong speed. And if you feel speedy and you feel like your jaw's going and your heart rate's up and you feel really speedy, then you're not ADHD. We've got this wrong. It's something else. It might be like a borderline personality disorder. It could be autism. You know, there's something going on here, though. And I was like, thinking to myself, oh, no, I know what this is going to do, because I've, all of my friends, all of my life have been like, how come you never get fucked? Oh. Like, everyone is super high. And I'm just sitting in the corner being like, I'm just going to write a shopping list. You know, like, I'm going to read this book. And I was like, I knew as soon as he said it, I was like, okay.
So it rebalanced you almost as opposed to made you speedy.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely. Everyone's always commented on it. Like, it's amazing how many drugs you can put into your body and never.
It's like a superpower.
So I took it and I couldn't. Because I wasn't drunk, or because we went on a night out and it was controlled and it was a small dose. And I, for the first time ever, I guess, must have had the clarity that non-neurodivergent people feel on a normal wow. day, right? And I was like, oh my goodness me. Like, I was like, hang on a minute. If this had been how quiet, how focused, how non-scattergun, non-anxious, non-ruminating, non-extreme emotions, like non-flicking thoughts from thing to thing, how none of that was there, I was like, I would run the world. if I was not neurodivergent, I would be president of the world by now, you know, like, because it was like, oh my God, it's like the noise just stopped like that. Not everybody responds like that. Like, I've got a lot of ADHD friends who struggle to find the right medication, but for me it was like the drugs were just like, okay, this is what it feels like to be normal. I was like, oh my goodness me. Oh yeah, I am ADHD.
And then you started that wow. acceptance that you talked about.
Yeah, then it's possible to kind of start looking at it as a really less grief stricken way, because it felt like I was getting somewhere. You know, like, it felt like all those things that always felt like a burden were turned down a little bit so I could get somewhere. So I could be like, okay, that's what that is. The reason why I haven't ever really quite been able to grasp my finances, or really ever been able to, you know, just have one drink, like, or not stop showing off on stage and be called back all the time to that kind of dopamine hit, is because that's what my brain has needed all this time. A deficit of dopamine has been present. And now I've got that dopamine, I can start to think about how I can change my existence through talking therapy, through different types of dopamine, and start to think about, it was forgiving. It was like, it's not your fault. And I think a lot of people with ADHD and autism have been led to believe that they're difficult, or they're led to believe that this, you know, this is your fault. You're just defective in some way. You're just kind of, there's something wrong with you.
Do you think that was helped by Frank and going through the autism diagnosis? Would it have been a different process? It hadn't been precipitated by that journey for Frank's diagnosis.
Hey, everything would be different if I didn't have Frank. You know, it's like, in a way, when you have a kid, you care about them way more than you care about yourself. Like, sadly, you know, now I'm learning through therapy that to love yourself is like 101, you know, like, to really care about yourself and to come back to yourself. But yeah, like, it was weirdly more important for me to get my shit together to parent rather than to get my shit together for myself. You know, it's like, anything I can do, it's always been that, anything I can do to help him. And in some ways it's quite nice, because you can be like, okay, I'm gonna try and fix myself because I've got something other than me to do, you know. So yeah, it would definitely, I don't think it would have happened if I hadn't had Frank. I think I would have spent the rest of my life just being like, oh yeah, maybe I'm a bit annoying and a bit weird and a bit over dramatic, and you know, that had caused such great anxiety and depression in my life, because that's what that does. If you don't diagnose neurodiversity, or you don't create an environment where it's okay to be neurodivergent, you comorbidly develop extreme mental illness or mental health problems. So
you talked about that when you did the I'm a Phoenix bitch and your struggles with postnatal depression. Do you think that was made worse because you had the ADHD that you didn't know?
Yeah, I think it was overwhelm, and yeah, it triggered a sort of psychosis in that way. But I think now I look back over my life, I can see periods where I've been extremely depressed and just denied it, or just medicated it with drink and drugs, or perhaps with, you know, well, actually no, not with normal medication. It's always been like it's always been present, but I've never been even thought about the fact that it's like a solvable, you know, that actually you don't have anxiety or depression, you have ADHD. And because it was undiagnosed for a really long time, you've developed anxiety and depression. And I think it was really helpful for me, not because there's anything wrong with having anxiety and depression, but because it was very helpful for someone who needs logical explanation for things to say, okay, that's logical to me. You know, stop trotting, shut up, you're overreacting, sit down and be quiet, and just stop being quite so much to a child. And then for the rest of your life, that is going to cause massive dis-ease and trauma. Yeah. So then that thought is like, anything I can do to stop that from happening to Frank is like, I have to do everything I humanly possible.
Why don't you tell us kind of what the day-to-day living is like for both you and Frank? Kind of what does that look like? How do you live your lives?
Well, before the diagnosis, it would involve a lot of drinking in the evening for me to try and block out everything that was going on. And in the daytime, it would involve a lot of small amounts of play, putting on the television to go and have a rest in the kitchen and then back in for like a small amount of play and then back again. And I recognized that I was doing what I needed to do, but I didn't know why. And so then the evenings would be full of guilt for like perhaps not engaging as much as other parents could. Not that, I mean, he was getting a lot of my time, but a lot of hiding, you know, resting, coming back. Because Frank's play is extremely repetitive. It's where he feels safe. It's what he wants to do, is repeat. And for an ADHD person, your worst nightmare is to do a boring, repetitive task. Like, it's just we're polar opposites to one another.
So yeah, I was going to ask, how must have that been so difficult? Because it goes so against your nature to do something so repetitive.
Yeah, I mean, you do it because you love them and you're like, I must do it. But you're also making yourself ill by doing it and not knowing why. And then I think that was causing so much anguish for me, because it was like, why can't I do this? Like, why? Like, what difference does it make if you pretend to be a dog 7,000 times in the same game, which is essentially still going on, which is, you walk past me, mummy, I'm a dog, I'm lying on the floor, I've hurt my arm, and you say, oh, this poor dog has hurt his arm, and then you pick me up and put me on the sofa, right? Okay, I'll do that. And then, okay, again. And then he lies back down on the floor and I have to walk past again and say, oh, this dog has hurt his arm, you know? And to variate it, I might be able to get away with like, let's see if we can bandage it up. And sometimes he might be like, no, that's not how the game works. Or sometimes he might be like, yeah, let's bandage it up. So like, why can't I just do that? What difference does it make to me to do that? I mean, it would drive anyone insane, right? But yeah. I think for me, yeah, it was like almost impossible. Anyway, so that was before. And then getting annoyed that I get annoyed, you know, or him getting upset because I said, look, 5 minutes, I don't want to play the dog game, you know. And also single parenting is super intense. So you don't have someone to go like, I'm having a bath, get this kid away from me for like half an hour and then I'll be back refreshed. So now it's really, really different. It's really different. He's older, so able to articulate himself more and able to understand my needs. He's learned a lot more how to say what he needs and how he feels. He understands that mummy is also neurodivergent, so we can both take turns to sit on the fizzy cushion or to move away.
Does he understand that you have a neurodivergence as well? Have you explained
He understands that I feel like I'm having a meltdown, or I feel like I'm fizzy, or I feel like I need to empty my worry bucket. Like, he does know that I also am the same as him, which I think he quite likes. And so we also live with two other people now. So we live with my partner and his daughter. So there is an element of it being like, okay, somebody tag team, which is helpful. But I think more it's, and I said to the youth, said this to you when we were talking before we did the podcast, it's like, happy mum, happy baby.
I hate that thing.
Happy yep. Mummy, happy baby. But
it's true.
Actually, it's true, annoyingly, and even more so if you have special needs kids. It's like, the more I put into my own healing, the more I put into my own mental health, the more I choose positive dopamine hits over negative, the more I'm able to help him. So you'll see me, you know, they always say, like, I don't know if they still say it now, but like 10 minutes of play a day is so, 10 minutes of one-to-one play for any child is just enough. And it's like, I think that's bullshit, because
I agree,
you need a lot more than that, but like, sadly, apparently that's all you need to do. But like, I have in my mind time for him. You know, this is the time. This is when I'm actually going to do stuff. And this is when I'm not. And that's okay. Like, I'm going to take myself into the garden and do some meditation. I'm going to put him in front of number blocks because he absolutely loves it and he needs a rest. And then we're going to have a really good play at this. And I try my best to just organize our lives into sort of but what we both need. I'm drinking less. He's drinking less, you know, all of that sort of thing. Yeah, we're just a bit more forgiving, I think. It's more, he doesn't quite grasp his own self yet. He's only 7.
What does he understand about neurodiversity then? What have you taught him?
Tricky to know, because they always say don't tell them, like they'll ask you. But I always thought that was a bit mean, because it's like, it's almost like they come asking you once something's happened that's made them feel different or weird. So I just tell him he's autistic. And I say it means he's got a totally different type of brain to most people. Mummy's ADHD. I mean, she's got a completely different brain to other people. And we see the world in a different way and we feel differently. And I tried to explain to him that lots of people don't really understand that, and that it's really important for us to understand ourselves so that we can articulate what we need to other people. But sometimes he'll say, I'm autistic. And I don't know whether he's just parroting that or if he actually gets it. But every now and then in the car on the way to school, we'll have a little deep and meaningful about, you know, what happened that's hard and how do we overcome that. And over time, I know he'll start to really be able to articulate how he's feeling about his autism. But he's actually more emotionally articulate than most kids I meet. You know, he's able to say, I'm feeling on the verge of a meltdown. I need to go and bounce on the trampoline. I need you to squeeze me. I don't want to get dressed for 5 minutes until my body's warm.
That's brilliant.
You know, like he's completely, yeah. So I think it's
credit to you and your embrace, amen. You know, embracing of what you need, what you feel kind of sentiment.
Yeah. He goes to a really good school that's very inclusive, very small, and lots of people with neurodiversity. So it's not a special school, but it is close. You know, he's always been on the cusp of always not been sure whether or not he should go to a special needs school or not. And I think for secondary, he's certainly not going to be able to go to a large, comprehensive 30 kids in a class kind of deal. Probably go to an autistic secondary school. But it's very much a place that's like, whatever you want, whatever you need. Like, everybody has sensory toys. Everybody can leave the classroom. Like, it's really, really beautiful school. So I moved him from quite a full-on city school, moved to the middle of nowhere to get him into this really, there's like 8 kids in this class. It's just like a like a state school, but just happens to be like in a tiny village.
Heaven.
Does he, you know, you've described how he kind of to some extent understands autism, or certainly there's threads of understanding there about difference and neurodiversity. Does he ever reflect back, you know, mummy might need time out, or mummy might need, you know, your own neurodiversity?
No, he sometimes asks me if I need the fizzy cushion, like if I'm getting a bit cross, he'd be like, go and sit on the fizzy cushion.
Yeah.
Okay. But he is more and more now, he asks me if I'm all right. Like he'll say, like I might say, oh, why are people, why would you do that? Like, or something, because I'm get quite fiery about, I don't like injustice. And the other day he put his, like, why would you pull out like that? Like, you know, in car park or something. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he went, are you all right?
Mature.
I was like, not really. And he was like, that's just
so wise.
And I was like,
you've brought him up so well.
Yeah. And he strokes my head.
From a mine, actually.
It's difficult, isn't it? Yeah. I feel like the sad thing is, and it's hard to think about, is that people are cunts, aren't they?
Completely.
Most people.
Yeah, it's hard.
And like the thought of people being horrible to him is like, you know, it's like my worst nightmare. Of course, you know, this feeling, it's like people looking at him, people judging him, people thinking they're better than him. Like, it just makes me want to punch them. But I can see that he's probably going to be one of these sorts of people that's just like, let them just
sounds like he's gonna be all right.
I'll just get on with myself. Yeah, he'll be fine. It's just,
he'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at yourself. Like, I do a lot of transactional analysis, which is, it's like a particular type of therapy that, like, you look at your child self and you look at your parent self and you look at your adult self, and there's like three different versions of you all having a big fight in your head most of the time. And like, when you're doing transaction analysis, you can start to identify when you might be in child mode, particularly, like, you're like reacting to something, but you're not reacting in your adult self. You're like, get off my toys, or don't put that there, or like, you hurt my feelings. And it's like, yeah, you're in child mode. And I guess my child mode is like super defensive, really scared, like really traumatized for all manner of reasons, and one of which being undiagnosed neurodiversity. And I'm just like constantly trying to think that his child mode, which is still developing. I mean, they say you stop developing child mode at 5, but I don't really see that as true. But I just want his child mode to be like, there's a state called adapted child, which is the one I'm always in, which is like the child reacts to something the adults do and it's traumatizing, and so the child is in constant fight or flight, really needs a lot of reassurance, a lot of love. And the other side of that, if you've had a good upbringing or like a adequate upbringing, is creative child, which is like free, playing, happy, secure. You know, like sometimes I can go into that mode and I'm just like constantly just trying to get that child in creative free child, you know, like not traumatized child. Because all the way through his life, in the thinking of transactional analysis, you revert to that child when you're in distress. So you want to, if it's a solid, creative, happy, well-built, resilient child, then yeah, it's okay. If it's not, he'll struggle.
So it sounds like you are parenting wonderfully and creating that secure child based on, I mean, you're just your own neurodiversity and your understanding of your own neurodiversity and your own childhood and how that's impacted you throughout your life. It's it's quite an insight that's allowing you to be brilliant parent to Frank that you clearly are. Thinking, I had a conversation with my 9-year-old the other day where she was asking me what autism was. So she's neurotypical, for want of a better term, and I was describing autism to her, and I kept using the word differences, and she was like, but everybody has a different brain, but everybody's different, but everybody feels this different. It's like, oh, I might have overplayed the differences, like points and the diversity points, because she's so aware of difference, because she's got a sibling who is neurodiverse, and she sees tons of kids with different disabilities all the time.
That's why she's looking at it like that. I think if you weren't exposed, you would be like, people think differently to me, people experience the world differently, ooh. And that's where that whole thing is from, I think. So Olivia's incredibly lucky that she's seen so much and is so conscious of the difference.
But it's it's just interesting, because I just think it's so, my whole childhood was completely different. Like, there was no, it was all about kind of, there's the difference over there. And, you know, it was, I'm sure I was socialized to believe all of these stereotypes that you described at the beginning around autism and ADHD, if I even knew what they were.
Yeah. I mean, they do live in a different world now, children. Like, I think there is more of an acceptance, probably not from the parents, but from the school. You know, often there's a lot more awareness around things and a lot more sort of holistic mental health and neurodiverse practice in school. But I still...
There's a long way to go.
Think, oh my God, such a long way to go. The things people say, you know, the things people say to you, or the things that people think, and... You just don't want to like go outside.
I was going to ask as well, how has like Frank and your kind of neurodiverse diagnoses or labels of autism and ADHD, how's that impacted on your relationships with others? Or, you know, you talked about your family, your mother, and your own kind of reflections of the jigsaw of your life fitting together. Have other people kind of had that experience of, oh, it makes sense now, or not? What's the reaction been?
I think it's a bit like when you have a poorly child or you have a sick child or a disabled child, and people will either come towards you or they run away. And it's not always the same people you think it will be. You know, you think, oh, they're a solid friend, and then they're headed for the hills. And people that you were like, I don't even really know you, come and knock on your door with like a lasagna and don't leave until you're okay again. And I think it's the same with particularly my diagnoses. I feel like you really quickly kind of weed out things that don't serve you when you realize that you're neurodivergent. You know, you're like clinging on to toxic friends or history's sake or duty, and then you think, that doesn't serve me and that makes me ill. You know, so it's almost like it's sort of like quite a nice way of just getting out the scissors and being like, bye. Because actually, I mean, maybe it's also just age. You start to be like, oh, I just don't have time. I don't have time for one-sided friendships. I don't have time to hear this every time, you know, like. So I think some people it's brought me closer to, and other people not at all, but it's definitely brought new friends. Like I've sought out ADHD women. I've sought out ADHD queers. I've sought out people who are neurodivergent, one, to be role models for my children, and also one, to be friends of mine. And it was a really nice moment a couple of times over the summer where Frank was with his dad and got this new house, and it's got a big garden, land and stuff, and it's quite a paradise to come to. And so a couple of times I've just invited new neurodivergent female friends over and taken some low-level mushrooms and just sort of splurged and sat and ate and lit the fire and talked about the world and how we see the world and how it's traumatized us, or how we you know, have helped ourselves. And it's been a real, to be honest, it's probably the first time I've ever really experienced friendship. That sounds really bad, and my best friends listening will be like, fuck you, Brian, and I'll be like, fuck you right back. But no, actually, a lot of my friends are neurodivergent. You know, the reason why we found one another now is we're realizing is because we were all neurodivergent. But it was very interesting. I taught a course the other day and it happened to have like 5 or 6 ADHD women on it. And everyone was at the pub. And of course, we were the ones drinking a lot and smoking, because that's sort of one of the things that seems to be quite a common trait. And it was like being in a parallel universe, because if you'd have watched it happening, you would have just seen chaos, because there was 5 or 6 conversations going on at once. Bits and bobs and chatting across, like it would have looked like chaos, but for me it was like oscillating at the same temperature for once as everybody else. And you can have many conversations at once. You are following lots of different things, and sometimes that's awful and sometimes it's really beautiful. And for the first time I was like, oh my god, we're like next level listeners, like we're just like da, 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 da. And then I was like, I found my little tribe. And I've always been at the edge, and I've purposefully always kept myself at the edge. And normally it would be like, I've got gigs so I can't come out, or I like, yeah, it's nice to meet you, but I just had a gig so I've got to go home, you know. Like it was almost like I chose that to keep myself out of social situations. And often I'd say, oh no, I've got a gig, I can't come, but I wouldn't, you know, it wasn't that I just didn't want to go, or I didn't want to address why, social anxiety wise, I couldn't go, or overwhelm wise I couldn't go. And it was like, oh yeah, this is what it feels like to be with your people.
And with you don't autism, want to leave.
You don't want to leave. But with autism, I don't think it's, it doesn't seem to be the same. Like I think of ADHD as very much, it needs people. It needs input. It really low level dopamine. So you need excitement. You need to gather. You need to be doing, like, it's like you need to be doing star jumps. As soon as you wake up in the morning, you need to get that dopamine into your brain. And autism seems to be quite solitary, quite self-assured. I mean, I don't know about mental health with Frank. I think there will be mental health issues that just come from not feeling like you're part of something, or maybe not even that, maybe feeling like you don't quite fit because the world isn't built for him. You know, he's living in a world that isn't designed for him, essentially. And he's having to do all the adaptations to make sure he's okay, putting on all the armor to make sure he can handle it. Not at home, that's completely the opposite. But like, so I feel like, yeah, I can't even remember the question, but I feel like I need to absorb people and he needs to just be left autonomously alone.
How do you do that then if you're both kind of, is it having a large enough house in the country?
Luckily for me, I'm his person. Like, I mean, luckily and unluckily, because he won't leave me alone.
That's good for you, because you need him all the
time.
Yeah,
I mean, unless it's the repetitive stuff. It's a constant balance. Luckily, we bought this new house. It's got a big fence around it. So it's like a sort of wild acre garden with like little zones and stuff, which we're turning into like a permaculture site. But it's got a fence all the way around it. Not that Frank would ever, you know, he's not the sort of kid that would ever go beyond a fence anyway. But it's like, it's got lots of different zones. So I feel like more so now than when we lived in this flat in Brighton with no garden, you know, it's just intense and in a pandemic. Now it's like more and more he'll go off. He likes to stare up at the trees a lot. Like, it's one of his favorite things to do is to stand in the trees and to hear the noise and to watch all of the leaves moving. So, and I think more and more as he gets older, that will be, you know, he'll find his way of self-soothing or finding his own joy. Because I think he looks to me quite often to be like, is it okay if I... But more and more, I think you'll just be like, oh, there's Frank over there, enjoying that, loving that moment.
But yeah, I think you described it to Tarina and I prior to recording as a neurodivergent utopia. What is your neurodivergent utopia that you're creating?
Well, it's about the social model of disability. You know, like, it's about not only teaching Frank that there's a medical model which tells you that you're lacking or that you've got something different that's difficult or that you've got a kind of, yeah, you've got, you're not normal, essentially. There's something wrong with you. And then there's a social model, which is the belief that the world is designed wrong. It's not designed for everybody. It's designed for people that are able-bodied, or people that don't have neurodivergency or don't have learning difficulties. And it's not the person that's wrong, it's the world. So if that's the case, which is what I'm trying to always tell Frank, like, if he doesn't like something, it's too loud, it's too noisy, it's too bright, I say that's not your fault, that's not designed for everybody, it's not right, it's not designed for everyone. So that means that if I've got this place, it's mine, I own it, I can do what I fucking want with it, and I can turn it into the perfect place for us, you know. So there's two non-neurodivergent people, there's two neurodivergent people with very opposing neurodiversity. So the idea is that by talking about our needs and our wants and how we feel, we can create space for everyone to exist here feeling like it's designed for them. So for example, the first thing we had to do was change Frank's bedroom, even though we're probably knock this house down. It's like falling down, like it needs to be like either like a huge amount of money spent on it or we're knocking it down. But his room, it had to be changed. It was black and white beams and it was all wonky And he was like, why is my room a slide and a prison? Is the first thing he said when he was in there, because it's like black and white bars and the floor was like literally 7 inches higher one end than the other. So of course it's like, you know, it, back in the day you'd be like, just shut up and go in there, you know, like that's your bedroom, like you think yourself lucky you've got a bedroom, you know, that's the sort of attitude I would have had from my parents. But it's like, level the floor, make everything soft, double thick underlay, paint the ceiling white, like make everything in there. I mean, parents do this with their disabled kids all the time, but it's like recognizing the fact that until you do that, until you make that room accessible, he can't be in it. Like, it's not fair for him to live in a world where it's like, that's just how it is. Sensory smells, garden is happening this next summer. Like, smells and sounds for him are just like, I think when he's in nature, it must feel like, it seems to feel like how I feel in nature when I've taken a few drops of mushroom oil, like, which isn't like, I'm not talking about doing, you know, going on a bender. I'm not drinking alcohol. I'm just taking a slight amount of psilocybin that gives everything a really different, sparkly, intense, very hyper-focused glow. And I think that that is what happens to him when he's in. I can see it. Like, he walk outside and he could listen to a bird and it's like, it's mainlining like euphoria into his body. His whole body vibrates. So like, I'm making him a garden that's going to have lots of bees in it. It's going to have beehives. It will smell insanely good. Different areas will smell of different things, the sound of things, the height of things. Just like, what do you feel and what do you need? I feel like I need to be in nature 80% of the time. Then boy, you are going to be in nature 80% of the time. If I have to take the wall off the side of the house and make it glass, you will be in nature. You know, like, it's just, I believe that he, not to spoil him, not to make it like, it's not that. It's what does the world look like if you listen to what people need, you know? Not just us either, like Will and Leela, she needs a Lego room. It's like, fine. Like, she just wants to do Legos. So, and on her own. So she has a Lego room. Like, it's small and she's small and it's Legos. And this is where I go to do my Lego.
Makes sense. It's things that make you happy, ultimately. Things that just make you happy.
Things that make you happy.
Damn. I think we want to come and visit this utopia, actually. It sounds glorious.
Honestly.
We're going to have to
say, hey, man, you can. I would really like to have a lot more land and a lot more, you know, like, I would like to have like places that people can come and rest and have, you know, I don't think it exists enough specifically, you know, respite something. But I have a friend who does this thing called, I can't remember what it's called, it's so annoying. It's like, he went into mental health hospitals and he asked the patients to redesign the hospitals. It's called something like something asylum, not fame asylum, something else. And you know, when they looked at what they needed, soft furnishings, soft cushions, different colors, less medical equipment, you know, the idea that just asking people what they need is doesn't really happen. Like, more land, so I can just like make little pods of like, this is the sensory deprivation pod, and this is the one where you get to hear only the nature around you. Like, you know, we're not connected to the nature and the planet anyway, you know, as human beings. I mean, my partner has this really strong feeling that there's a nature deficit disorder, as well as an attention deficit disorder. There's a hole in most people that needs filling, and they fill it with other things.
They need that grounding, like socks off, feet on the ground.
I could believe that for sure.
I think, I feel like there's definitely, I notice it like in winter, because obviously I'm not going to like go to the heath then like take my socks off and just like run around the heath when it's like 0 degrees. I can definitely feel the, yeah, I you do. Are in a different type of human to me. And I can feel it like the minute it starts going into autumn, and it's obviously the SAD, and it's just like a mix of everything. There's definitely, it's a shitty season until that it gets warmer and then you can like, yeah.
Recently, I've been looking at the pagan calendar because one of Frank's obsessions is celebrations.
What a great obsession.
So like it got really bad at one point. It was like, what's today? It's like, it's National Hug Day, it's National Waving Day, it's National Everyone Wears Yellow Day. Like it was like whatever day, it just had to be a day. But I started to get like the feeling that a lot of that was kind of capitalism. He was like, what am I getting today? And it's like, okay. Let's do something else. So I started to look at the pagan calendar, and you know, not to be too hippie about it, but like the way in which the seasons work and the celebrations of the seasons. This book was describing how the solstice is the beginning of the year because it's the darkest day. Yeah. It means everything after that gets lighter. Yeah. And I like that. Like I was like, oh, I can deal with that. It's like just a few more weeks until it's the end of the death and the birth begins. And I was like, okay, good. So yeah, lots of trying to teach the kids about how to plug into what's around us, like self-sufficiency, you know, the fact that the soil has a natural serotonin in it, like trying to plug ourselves back into nature because we have the luxury of being in this land, and something about it is healing us all.
I don't want to bring us down after such a positive discussion, but what have you found hardest to get right in this creation of this neurodivergent utopia, or the way that you're parenting Frank? What's been the hardest thing for you two?
I think the hardest thing for me, not for him, for me, is that learning about ADHD means that I've learned that we're very hypersensitive to emotions. So perhaps the feelings that we're feeling are they're bigger than most people would feel, right? So if you feel rejected, you feel like 50 times more rejected, right? That's like one of the symptoms of having ADHD. And it's definitely one of mine, particularly when I'm in a hormonal period of time. And knowing that logically, I understand it, I can hear it. But mental illness and mental health is the same feeling. It gives me this real head fuck moment, which is like, I know the logic, but I'm also feeling the feeling. Like there's no way that you can tell yourself stop feeling that feeling. Do you know what I mean? So like that feeling of trying your best not to be hurt by something, or trying your best not to feel completely at the edge of something, while simultaneously kind of being like, it's okay to feel all these emotions. Like I find it quite confusing. And I found it really difficult for a while I was just trying to censor everything, which then, you know, if you try and censor your emotions, you absorb them, it gives you illness inside. So, I think the hardest thing has been to have volcanic emotion and try not to, if it erupts, to not spend the next week feeling just awful, you know, awful that you exploded, or awful that you were short, or awful that you couldn't deal with it that day. Like it's been really hard to forgive. It's been really hard to love myself enough. So that's been hard. It's also hard I think one of the hardest things with Frank is trying to understand what he needs. Like he finds speaking difficult. So he's not nonverbal, but he doesn't speak very well yet. And also he's autistic. He doesn't know what it's like not to be autistic. So to sort of say, what's going on in there? It's like, well, what's always going on in here? You know, like it doesn't have consciousness enough to be able to say, well, I assume that you don't feel like this, so I can describe to you kind of how it feels. So sometimes I just want to like climb inside his head and just be like, tell me, I don't understand. Like, I cannot understand. I don't. And I feel so stuck, and I can see him trying to explain to me, and I'm just like, I don't understand. And that's very painful. you know, painful, because you can see it's painful for him, you know. And, you know, the worst is to see your children in pain, isn't it? But, yeah, so it's difficult sometimes sort of waving across the two planets that we're on and being like, I'm here, but I can't help right now. And he's like, I'm over here and I don't understand why you can't just come. And I think another difficult thing was probably accepting, when I realised that I myself was neurodivergent, accepting that I'd been very, very ableist towards my own child, you know, that I'd othered him. I'd been like, yeah, he's disabled. Yeah, he's over here. And he like, yeah, we're trying our best to just like get onto his planet, but I can't do it. And like, that's because he's disabled, you know, like, and that thing of like, oh, actually, I've been doing that. Until I realized that had happened to me, I wasn't able to sort of look at him with perhaps the empathy I can now, which is like, oh my God, like, I've been othering you since you were ill, like since you were born. How has that affected you? Like, yes, it's a really difficult thing to admit, you know, because as a parent of a disabled kid, you want to be like, look, man, I'm the fucking biggest disabled champion there is out there. No one can fucking mess with me. Like, I'm so down with all this stuff. So then to sort of realize, oh, wow, I've been applying the medical model of disability to my own son. It's like, oh, fuck.
And the guilt that comes with that, I guess. But
yeah.
But then that's because you've lived in a society that told you that your entire life. Yeah. So it's not. It's the fact that you're aware of it now and you have that understanding and empathy is going to serve Frank so well in the long term.
Yeah, but don't you ever feel like that feeling of like, why doesn't everybody else just get with the program? You know, it's all, like you
every fucking day
shake people and just be like, look, this isn't a podcast for people that already know this stuff. This should be this is a podcast for people that have just have no idea what it's like to be, you know, to be dealing with these things either as a parent or as the child, you know. It's completely. Like you don't fucking know, do you, until it happens to you.
Yeah. Which leads us on really nicely to your fucking normal. What is your fucking normal?
Okay, so I decided that my fucking normal was. So my fucking normal is playing the dog game for the 7,000th time while simultaneously doing star jumps and trying not to drink wine.
You know, I can picture that so clearly in my mind.
Yeah.
The visual is fantastic.
I feel like I could incorporate wine into the dog game. But one shouldn't.
I mean, but I'm trying not to.
I know.
Well, I think that we've got this thing in our house called the dopamine menu where you're like, I feel low dopamine. Instead of being like, what the hell's wrong with me? It's like thinking of it as a diabetes thing. It's like I don't have enough sugar in my system. It's like I have low dopamine. What are the things that I can do to build up my dopamine? And when my dopamine's at a good level, I can play the dog game till the cows come home. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like if I do star jumps instead of drinking wine, I can play the dog game for the 7,000th time, and that's my fucking normal.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you so much,
Bryony.
It's been fun.
So, so interesting. You are incredible. Thank you for being so open and honest and interesting and fabulous.
Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We are part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So, if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Mwah.